This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, a staff writer at The New Yorker. I've been following this comedian, Jerrod Carmichael, for quite a while. He was in a movie that I liked, Neighbors. And then I saw a stand-up special of his. It's called Love at the Store. And that was back in 2014. And just this year, in March, he released a new one. It's called Eight. He's also just starting the third season of his NBC sitcom, The Carmichael Show, which is loosely based on his stand-up. And also points to what is so great about his work to me. It is a guy swimming through issues of race, politics, the social world with perfect ambivalence. Comedians these days, I find, tend to be very opinionated. They're almost sort of organs of social critique, and they feed really on strong opinion. This guy has no strong opinions, and that's what's so funny about him. It strikes me like everybody who does the stuff that you do, right, this film and TV or stand-up specials, all this, these markers of success have these stories, right, of how they go from where they started to where they are. But it seems to me that you, this is part of your act.
Am I going to forget where I came from? Of course I am. Like almost immediately. Like I don't even like the term give back to the community. Because it implies the community gave me shit in the first place. Which they didn't. Community gave me shit. The community stole my bike. That's what the community did. The community. Like, I don't know if you guys ever
When you go back home after all this success, right? You're going into the third season of a sitcom.
Oh, yeah.
You just had a new HBO special. I felt watching you sometimes that you have this like conflicted. Almost like, is there a guilt that you feel about the change, this crazy change in your circumstances, or like,
or even the guilt in the acceptance of the change of circumstances? Like how it's like immediately accepted and liked, you know, like like from being poor to not being poor, or whatever, and then you feel guilty for how much you enjoy it. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like that conflict is interesting. That's why I talk about it and write about it because it's a lot. So when I go home, I actually I'm my happiest because I'm just around my family. I don't really do anything other than go eat with my family. I'm usually just in. I see friends and people, and that's it.
Is it weird? Like, is their relationship to you different? Does it strain those relationships?
I get away with a little bit more.
Okay.
You know, I get away, you know, a little bit more. As it turns out, if you redo your mom's kitchen, she'll cook whatever you want in it.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So that type of stuff. But they still also treat me the same. You know, my brothers, you know, I mean, I love him so much. He's a big champion of my career. My sister's the most honest person in my life. You know, and my dad is always cautious of everything.
Yeah.
You know, any little thing. A friend of mine, a comedian friend, bought me a watch once, and he was just like, "What did he want for?" I was like, "Dad, I'm not
right." He's not trying to like get me into a gang.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I'm not in a gang. I didn't. It was a nice gesture.
Right.
Yeah. But he's very. I'm glad he is. You got to be.
You need that person.
Yeah.
So, what was it like growing up in Winston-Salem? I'm sure it's incredibly different from your life now in L.A. What was it like?
I mean, growing up in Winston-Salem was. I had a really fun. I was just telling someone how like my existence was all black until high school. It was like I really think that my elementary school was like this mission by the NAACP. You know, I learned the Negro National Anthem before the National Anthem.
Right.
Black History Month was just this year-long thing. Right. Like, really. And then high school, I went to like this integrated high school, and it was like you kind of learn, oh, man, culture, like just like a different side of things. And mm-hmm. it was very interesting. So like I kind of use that curiosity to propel me into Los Angeles and into, you know, what the world is. My life is like this field trip, right? You know, like, but Winston-Salem, just like these strong, very, you know, very Christian, loving, loyal people that I grew up around. Yeah. That was, you know, it was a beautiful childhood.
Were you, is it kind of tight-knit in terms of neighbors, or you know everybody in the street kind of thing?
Or? Yeah, we all, like, you know, I'm from the hood, so a lot of my social interactions are rooted in that. Yeah. That's why Hollywood is so fun, because nobody fights you. You're like, in my mind, everything's going to lead to an actual fight, but people just, you get like a sassy email.
This stuff reminds me of another aspect of your new special, where you talk about this feeling of wanting to be a good black person.
It's hard. Being a great black person, it's a lot of work. It's exhausting being black. It is, you know? Yeah, right? It's a lot of work, right? Every day you wake up and it's an added element. It's a lot of work. I mean, sure, it looks fun.
I thought that was so funny, just because for me, right, I work for The New Yorker, and I feel there's a part of my brain that's tuned to this, like, is what I'm doing a credit to my race?
Is it contributing?
This whole thing, right? Yeah. And I struggle with that. I just wonder how that... When you talk about that, does that show up in, not just in terms of success, but does that show up in your work? Like, does that constrain the way you write jokes, or does it determine the kinds of jokes you write?
My obligation is always to truth first, mm-hmm. right? So that's the biggest contribution we can give, you know, especially in the creative industry, because a lot of times, you know, a black person tends to write aspirationally, mm-hmm. you know, and write what we think the picture should look like, right, as opposed to the picture itself. The reason hip hop, you know, at its best resonates with so many people, because it's the rawest truth of both poverty and the celebration of wealth.
Right.
And it's where we are in this moment, and it's honest. Mm-hmm. I try to just stay in that pocket of truth, and then I think I really am contributing. But there, it is a conscious thing. You are aware of it because, I mean, especially when you see, you know, things that seem to plague people that look like you.
Right.
You know, and you share these fears and you share these concerns. You know, I'm as susceptible to being shot by the cops as, you know, my brother in North Carolina, as my cousins, as my friends. You know, it's like you don't forget what you look like and who you are, right, and your place in America, but also don't forget to be a human being first.
Right.
Yeah.
It seems like you're comfortable being in that place. I heard a story, I think you told it, about Love at the Store, where Spike Lee was like pissed off about one of your jokes.
Oh, yeah. And I don't even know.
Who was directing?
I'm not even sure if we're talking to each other right now.
Because of that?
He got mad at a few things. And I'm sure he would tell you. He disagreed with a lot of the material. Yeah. It was very strong.
This was a Trayvon Martin joke in specific.
Oh, yeah. Because, right? Well, he didn't understand the perspective that I was taking on it.
And the other day, I was walking into my building, and I walked past my guard, and I had a hoodie on. And he didn't stop me. And I was concerned. Very concerned. And I turned around, I talked to him, and I said, Joe, his name is Joe. I said, Joe, I just walked by you with a hoodie on. You didn't notice anything suspicious about that? And he said, no, Gerard, you live in the building. And I said, I know. And I pay a lot of money. Like a lot of money. So that like me and hoodies can't just waltz by you. So you know what I told him? I said, next time, stand your ground. That's what I told him. I told him to stand his ground. Don't groan. You have nothing to worry about. I gave him my gun. You have nothing to worry about. You guys felt, you guys went, oh, really? Because that Trayvon shit is really affecting your day-to-day? Your day-to-day. You wake up, you have your cup of coffee. You do this to a picture of Trayvon. And you start your day. Is that what you do? Because you don't. Can I tell you the harsh reality?
It was a challenge to others of how much they cared, mm-hmm. you know, and I get it. A lot of people hear, a lot of times, especially with my comedy, people hear certain words and they don't really listen.
Yeah.
They hear the buzzword and they go like, oh, I can't believe. And they, you know, they mm-hmm. immediately take to Twitter because that's the new soapbox. You take the Twitter and you disagree, and you vehemently disagree with a thing that I said without really listening or understanding where the place that this person is in when they're saying these things. And, you know, and Spike just had this immediate knee-jerk reaction to not only that, but, you know, all these things that he was just like, no. And he got first cut, and it was a completely different special than what you saw.
Oh, wow, yeah.
He
took that stuff out?
Stuff out. That basically, it. He just took stuff out, yeah.
So and then you had to have an argument all of it back in.
No, I mean, you know, ultimately I you know, got final cut, and I just made the special that I wanted. But, you know, his version would have been completely different. I respect that. I really respect it. I respect the argument. And we had a couple great phone conversations. I went to Brooklyn, went to 40 Acres, and
nice.
We talked things out and some texts that are funny and that are, you know, funny in hindsight. And Yeah.
I've read, I think, that you went to church as a kid. You grew up in going to church, like choirs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, my first interactions with microphones. Like, my mom would, she was like an usher at the church, and when it was over, I used to stay, and she would like hold me up to like microphones because I wanted to speak into it. I wanted to hear my voice, you know, echoing off the wall. It was, I'm infatuated. That's all I asked for Christmas. Before I knew I wanted to be a comedian, I knew I wanted to do something with microphones.
That guy has one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I wanted microphones.
Yeah. But I kind of thinking about church and kind of, I think of you as a sort of agnostic comedian, right? Like you just can't commit yourself in the same way that someone like wants to believe in God and can kind of almost intellectualize themselves in it, but can't cross the line. I wonder, like, what's your thing about religion now? Do you still go to church?
I don't really go to church, but I consider myself Christian. I'm stronger spiritual beliefs than societal.
Right.
Like a very, very strong, clear understanding of myself as a spiritual being and an acceptance of that as truth. And, you know, that's much clearer than whether or not I should recycle. That's muddier to me than mm-hmm. my relationship with God. So, yeah, that I'm the least agnostic when it comes to where people are usually the most.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting.
In L.A. is a funny, it's funny because, you know, nobody believes in God in L.A. Not nobody, it's a few of us, but
But does that come up when you're thinking about your comedy? Do you think of it as an expression of some of the things you believe that aren't societal, the way you do your work? Or
do view religion as such?
Yeah, does that show up in your work at all, or is it drive?
I like to believe so. I mean, it's a... I use language that my mom would disagree with, you know, but I like to believe that it's a part of everything. Okay. I believe it's kind of, you know, in my fingerprint at this point.
Right.
She gets mad. Yes.
She does get mad.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
About you.
Oh yeah. She can't stand it. And she, you know, respectfully says that I wish you wouldn't use these words, and sometimes not respectfully, and she yells at me, and then I say, you know, come on, let's not be children about this.
I'm sure that goes over great.
Oh yeah, and then we get an argument and a whole thing.
I saved this for last because I hate the Donald Trump overcast of everything, but I feel like even in Love at the Store, it's pretty dark in its way. I think you've got this sort of bleak sensibility in your work.
You know what's funny? I realized that through, like, reviews more than, like, because my intention, I'm like, I thought we were having fun. We were just expressing thoughts. I say a thing, I express it, and then people are like, man, that was dark. I was like, oh, was it?
Yeah.
I don't feel dark going into it, but, you know, obviously the material is very, you know, provocative in that sense, but yeah.
What's important for me to say to you guys is that Trump's victory is in no way indicative of a loss for women. It's not. It's not a loss for women. It is, however, just another victory for men. Congratulations, guys. We did it again. We did it again. We still got it. We still got it. Still crazy after all these years, you guys. Look at us. Come on. That's amazing, right? We've been dominating for how long now? Forever?
There's a sort of, I just think, this is my, whatever, two cents, but it seems like there's always this question behind all of it. And I think that's the dark part. That's like,
yeah,
what is any of this anyway? That's like the thing that nobody, yeah, you know, we all kind of think about, but you kind of like.
A natural skeptic. Yeah.
But has Donald Trump, this, you taped 8 after the election.
Yes. That was the thing I waited for.
Uh-huh.
I felt like, I was like, you want to see how the world is going to change. So I was,
yeah.
I still wanted to wait and see what happened.
Yeah.
What I really think Donald Trump is you know, like in spy movies,
mm-hmm.
you know, where, you know, they're surrounded by the infrared beams or whatever, and they have like this mist that they spray and it lets you know where all of the wires and the beams are. That's right. What Donald Trump is to, right. I think, American society. I think he let us know where boundaries are, where we stand as Americans. And so, you know, if there's any good that comes from it, it's that, you know, that we are very aware,
right.
Boundaries and limits and as awake now as we've ever been.
Yeah.
Gerard Carmichael. He has a sitcom on NBC called The Carmichael Show, and that's going into its third season. And he talked with The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.